thank you very much for the kind invitation to come over to Perimeter. It's been great already, and I'll be here until Thursday, so I look forward to hopefully seeing a couple of you throughout the week and talking in more detail. And today what I want to do is I want to talk a little bit about our work that we've done on simulating a model to try and study some pneumatic the effect of pneumatic fluctuations and superconductivity in some toy models that we hope are relevant to the iron nictides, and in particular iron selenide. So before I go on, I want to acknowledge my collaborators, so in particular Maxime Serbin, who's a postdoc at Berkeley, and then Richard Skeletor at UC Davis, who's been very supportive in a lot of the Monte Carlo work, and of course my advisor Ashwin. So what I want to do today is I want to kind of motivate the model we've been considering and the study we've been considering from two different perspectives. The first is from an experimental perspective, sort of briefly introduce some things about the iron nictides and chalcogenides, and then also from a theoretical perspective from general considers about pneumatic quantum critical phenomena and why we should be interested in superconductivity close to pneumatic quantum critical points. Then I really want to introduce the toy model that we've been studying and give us some of the interesting results that we see. So since their discovery about 8 years ago, the iron-based superconductors have caused a lot of excitement because they're another form of strongly correlated systems where we can explore some of the interesting ideas we have about exotic mechanism for superconductivity and strongly coupled superconductivity. So here I've shown a couple of pictures of the iron-based superconductor, and the essential physics is, maybe I'll use a hockey stick. So the essential physics is contained in the iron planes, which form a square lattice, and there's some parallels there to the copper oxide planes, which are of course the important physics in the cuprate materials. And here in the bottom, I've sort of depicted the generic phase diagram of a lot of the iron nictide-based materials. There are a couple of different orders seen. Predominantly, there's a spin density wave here, very closely followed by this green area. I'm sorry the label didn't come out, which is a pneumatic phase where the C4 symmetry is broken. And those two join the superconducting phase at low temperatures, and they join very close to the optimal doping temperature. And so, of course, some of the major questions that have been asked is, what's the relationship between these different phases? How does the magnetism of the spin density wave affect the superconductor? To what extent is the pneumatic the pneumatic green phase that is shown there related to the spin density wave? Is it really a separate phase, or should we think of it as being some sort of a parasitic or vestigial phase really closely tied to the magnetism? And of course, what is the relationship to the superconductivity that emerges? So for a lot of the iron-based superconductors, and in particular for the barium iron isenide, a picture is emerging that essentially the spin density wave and the magnetism is the driving mechanism that enhances superconductivity and gives rise to the dome in the superconducting behavior. But one material that has gathered a lot of attention is iron selenide, because it sort of has unique properties that fall out of the typical picture of the other iron nictides. So in particular, in the bulk material, you see pneumatic order, and the C4 symmetry breaking, but you don't see any magnetic order in the bulk state. It is only under pressure that you see an actual long-range magnetic order. The bulk material itself is superconducting, but only at very low temperature. But when you dope the bulk very highly, for example, by adding potassium that then intercalates through the various layers, then you can get an enhanced TC of up to 40 to 50 Kelvin. And so this enhancement of the TC from 8 Kelvin to 40 to 50 Kelvin just because of doping is already one of the mysteries of the iron selenide superconductors. The second mystery, and in a sense one which has gathered even more attention, is that when you take a monolayer of this iron selenide and place it on strontium titanate, on doped strontium titanate, then the superconducting temperature can be enhanced even further. Some reports are up to 65 Kelvin. The record is slightly above 100 Kelvin. So here on the right, I've given some of the data for the monolayer strontium titanate. So in particular, this is one of the first groups that reported it. Here we have the iron selenide grown on niobium-doped strontium titanate, and this is a four-point in situ, four-point terminal resistance measurement, and you see that in zero external magnetic field, you get this sharp drop indicating TC just below 100 Kelvin. The data here at the bottom is, I'm sorry if the numbers are a little bit small, they're taken from ARPIS measurements, extrapolated TCs from ARPIS, where you have potassium-coated iron selenide films, also grown on strontium titanate, where in a thick samples of 20 monolayer, the TC is very small. As you decrease the thickness to 3 monolayers, you get a small dome, as you might expect in the doped bulk, and really when you get to 1 monolayer, you get this huge increase in the gap that they can see with ARPIS, and if they try and map that onto an actual temperature, they get values which are above 100 Kelvin. Of course, these are ARPIS data, but still, somehow there seems to be a mechanism that really enhances TC. I know there's been a lot of debate in the community as to the mechanism of this enhancement with many different explanations, some which are intrinsic to the iron selenide exotic mechanisms, which are probably responsible for the enhanced TC also in the doped bulk samples, and then some substrates effects, which are particularly responsible for the enhancement on strontium titanate. Yes. So here the x-axis is doping, which is done I guess this is done with a potassium.
The blue phase is the main phase.
Sorry?
Is the blue phase the main phase?
Okay, so the blue phase here is an extrapolation from a different set of data which sees some sort of feature at that temperature, and it's presumed to be the pneumatic phase. I don't think in this particular, there wasn't an independent, here they just call it a parent phase, so I'm not sure that, and on these sample they actually did a careful characterization of what it is. Yes, so this is also in the pure case, right? So, I guess one of the questions, so there is this separation between the highly doped bulk case, which, you know, and this enhancement to 40 and 50 Kelvin, which is probably due to some intrinsic mechanism, and then the enhancement up to possibly 100 Kelvin, which is some interface effect. And I really want to focus on this enhancement to 40 and 50 Kelvin and say, well, if pneumatic order is seen in the bulk, and if we don't see any magnetic order, how far can we get just assuming that pneumatic fluctuations are responsible for the superconductivity? So from a theoretical perspective, it's very natural to consider pneumatic fluctuations as being important, and a lot of work has been done theoretically on pneumatic quantum criticality. And by pneumatic criticality, I'm really thinking of some sort of intrinsically electronically driven phase transition in a metal from a Fermi liquid, which preserves the C4 symmetry, to one of the broken symmetry down to C2, as I've sort of sketched in this Fermi surface here. And we know that if I have some generic phase diagram here as a function of delta, which could be doping or pressure or some tuning parameter of the phase transition, and then at some of that critical value, the pneumatic fluctuation, the icing pneumatic fluctuation coupled to the entire Fermi surface strongly and give rise to a non-Fermi liquid. And this is something that a lot of people have worked on, of course, also here. And we know that this non-Fermi liquid is intrinsically unstable towards superconductivity. And so this, of course, has been proposed in many different contexts as being responsible for the superconducting dome we see in the iron-based superconductors or even in the cuprate superconductors. Now, of course, there's a very important question when we're dealing a theoretical question in this picture. On the one hand, the critical fluctuation act as a sort of pairing glue, which enhances the pairing between the fermionic quasi-particles giving rise to superconductivity. At the same time, the critical fluctuations destroy the destroy the fermionic quasi-particles, which are actually involved in the pairing to begin with. So it's an open question whether or not we're really in one of the two regimes here, where we see a non-Fermi liquid regime coming out of the critical dome, or where the superconductivity completely wins and we don't see any incoherent regime at all. And then there are questions about trying to verify various theories about the universal exponents above the dome and the nature of the critical scaling in the non-Fermi liquid regime.
I have a question.
Yes, of course.
So when you say that when you have a non-Fermi liquid which is intrinsically unstable towards superconductivity, do you know what to assess the temperature scale or energy scale of this superconductivity?
So as I said, it's the right. So at the end of the day, because you're in the critical regime, it's the actual where this temperature scale is itself. You don't know. So in some of the calculations, for example, in the paper by Max and David, the height of that actual superconducting dome is set by the epsilon expansion that is used to control the calculation itself. Because it's the critical fluctuations, you don't get an intrinsic. Sorry, I'm not explaining this. So the competition, you have the competition between the pairing itself and the actual destruction. But you know exactly where that line is itself, as compared to the scale where the incoherent regime gets cut off, is something which is set by the parameter you use to control your calculation. And that's why we have the question of whether or not we see the incoherent regime in this calculation at all. Does that? So the one thing I did want to mention very briefly is that, of course, in the iron nictides, we do have a tetragonal transition. We do have a pneumatic phase. But in various ways, we see pneumatic order or evidence of pneumatic fluctuations, even in quotes, far away from the tetragonal phase. So here I'm showing two different experiments. One is on electron doped with barium iron arsenide from the group of Ian Fisher, where basically they put the material on a piezoelectric and apply strain and then measure the resistive anisotropy and therefore can deduce the pneumatic susceptibility. And what they extract from this, and they see that it fits beautifully to a Curie-Weiss temperature behavior at high temperature, and they can extract an effective Curie-Weiss temperature and see that in their extrapolation it hits zero underneath the dome, slightly above optimal doping, and in some sense, not quite where the extrapolation from the tetragonal phase would be. In a different experiment, this is isovalently doped barium iron arsenide, and there's been some experiments via torque magnetometry where they claim to see electronic pneumatic order in a whole range far above the tetragonal transition. This data is still a bit controversial, and not many other groups have seen evidence of this. There have been, however, some recent experiments at Berkeley where pump probe experiments were done, where the metals would hit with incident light and the perpendicular response measured along the two different axes. And that's a violent non-equilibrium probe, but what they see is also at least evidence of pneumatic fluctuation in an area above the structural transition itself, and this dashed line is the area where the data I showed just a moment ago was. So it's clear that pneumatic fluctuations exist in these materials. It's clear that they might be responsible for the superconductivity or are at least intrinsically related to the superconductivity. In these materials, of course, there is magnetism, which plays a key role. But it still begs the question, to what extent can pneumaticity alone explain the superconductivity and these effects? And that really motivates us to study a purely pneumatic model and see how much mileage we can get out of it. So with that, I want to introduce the model that we actually studied. So it's a two-band model, which was inspired, which is a restricted model that we know doesn't capture the full phenomenology of the iron nictides, but it roughly reproduces the basic Fermi surface seen in a lot of these materials. So here we have a basic 2D orbital sitting on a square lattice of the iron atoms, with some nearest neighbor hopping and next nearest neighbor hopping. And the parameters I've chosen here were parameters that were fit to some LDA calculations, LDA plus DFT calculations, but the parameters we chose are possibly a little bit old, and there are certainly better calculations to reproduce the phenomenology. But it has the essential features that we require, namely a hole pocket in the middle of the Brillouin zone, then these a corner hole pocket here, and then two electron pockets here and here. And so the interaction that we're going to pick is a little bit of a weird interaction. And it's basically one of the reasons we chose this is foreshadowing for what I'm going to say in a moment, because it allows us to effectively simulate this model. The interaction is attractive, g is negative here, and it consists of an on-site Hubbard-like term, delta n, delta n, where delta n is the difference in occupation between the spins on one orbital and the spins on the other orbital. So if we actually expand out that term, what we have is effectively Hubbard interactions which are attractive in one orbital and that they're repulsive on-site between the orbitals. And basically what that will do is that will strongly favor this material to actually orbital polarize and therefore break the C4 symmetry and give us a pneumatic. Now, as I said, we really chose this interaction because it will allow us to numerically simulate this effectively, but actually you can get that out of various microscopic models. One way you could get it is if you have a repulsive on-site U term and a repulsive next nearest U term, where the next nearest repulsive U term is larger than the on-site one. That's not entirely natural, but if that does occur, then you can derive some model which then you can derive that this interaction term actually does appear. Another way you can get this interaction term where it has been proposed is through some optical phonon coupling, which then mediates also the pneumatic symmetry breaking. And then finally, if you want to think about it that way, you can think about doing some rather complicated repulsive Coulomb interaction calculation, see that there is a pneumatic response, and really think about this as a term that captures the essential pneumatic symmetry breaking due to complicated electron-electron repulsion. So in order to numerically simulate this, yes?
Sorry. Could you say, give a word for this next 10 years? Neighbor, that's like you're putting in a...
You're putting in like an on-site U and then a bond U prime, both of which are repulsive. But the the bond U prime is a lot bigger than the on-site term.
But this is purely on-site.
This is purely on-site. But essentially, it'll also give you that there's some sort of effective attraction in the same orbital, because that's really the difficult thing to argue, that the two electrons would like to sit in the same orbital and then orbital polarize. Okay, so we want to numerically simulate this model, and of course, the typical challenges of simulating fermion models emerge. We want to do it in a case at low temperatures where quantum fluctuations are important. We're dealing with a metal, so there are many energy scales, and we have a system with lots of different Fermi surfaces. Of course, naively, we have a sign problem. And the way we're going to deal with this is to use determinant quantum Monte Carlo that has the advantage of being able to actually sample the fermions in an unbiased way. And really, the way we chose the interactions is such that we engineered the couplings in such a way that we can avoid the sign problem, and that time reversal symmetry will protect us and allow us to sample it in a sign problem free way. So I know a lot of people here have done determined quantum Monte Carlo studies. I do want to spend one very brief slide giving an overview to those who haven't. Basically, the idea is you take the full partition function of your fermionic system on a lattice and sample it. The way you sample it is you write down the fermionic path integral, because it's a quantum mechanical system, we're now dealing with a space-time lattice, and you integrate out the fermion in favor to some Hubbard-Chertanovich fields, which is bosonic and sits on every site. And then in terms of the integrated out Hubbard-Chertanovich field, you now get a classical bosonic problem, which lives on the space-time lattice, but which has a very complicated interaction term, which comes from the fact that it is effectively a fermionic interacting problem. But as you see, if we integrate out the model we have, and I've sort of sketched it here schematically, when we integrate out the model we have, the form of the interaction was such that there was time reversal symmetry which exchanged spin up and spin down. And that symmetry means that these two Green's functions, the spin up Green function of the fermions and the spin down Green function of the fermions, are equal, and that guarantees that all the terms in our partition function are positive, and we can sample this in a sign problem free way. Right? And this also holds true at finite density. We're not considering a half-filled case at all, and so that's what makes this model a little bit special. The lattice sizes we're sort of limited to by the computational intensity of the technique is about 12 by 12 in spatial sites. In addition, we, of course, have the orbitals that adds an extra factor of 2. We also have spin in our problem, and we also have the time slices. So in total, with about 100 time slices, we're able to get to a couple of thousands of total space-time sites, which is roughly what maybe not the best classical Monte Carlo simulations can do, but what pretty reasonable, we do get to a pretty reasonable space-time lattice size. I don't want to go into too much detail of the actual code itself, except a few comments which distinguish it. So it's a new code that I wrote from scratch. The one technical comment I'll make for the experts who work on quantum Monte Carlo is that in order to really achieve decent ergodicity, we really had to overcome strong ergodic problems, and we implemented a parallel tempering algorithm. So parallel tempering, for those of you who haven't heard it, is a very neat idea. The idea is that you simulate a lot of different systems at the same time, say at different temperatures or at different coupling strengths, and then you try and propose changes in the configurations you're sampling between the different interaction strengths. And so I've drawn that schematically on the right-hand side, that we have some Hubbard-Chertanovich fields for each of the simulations we're doing, and then we try and exchange them between the different runs. And you can think about this as being a sort of super annealing mechanism, which helps overcome ergodicity when a simulation gets stuck in a local minimum. I'm happy.
Are you tempering in temperature? I didn't get it. What's your parameters?
The parameter is the interaction strength, and that's really because when we change temperature, we also change the number of time slices, and so we just can't take it from one time slice to the next. There are ways to do determinant quantum Monte Carlo in continuous time, so there I guess you can also temper.
But it's more ergodic and low interactions for
me? It's computationally easier because at high temperature you want to use the fact that you don't have to use that many time slices. It essentially has the same effect because at weak coupling, it's Gaussian and converged very quickly. And then we shuttle from weak coupling to stronger coupling where we actually get into the symmetry breaking phase. So some technical values, again, for people who do these types of numerics. So we choose about 1/16th is our time interval step for the number of time slices we choose. Because we have a lot of different Fermi pockets, we get into a lot of numerical rounding error instability problems, and we have to do stabilizing singular value decompositions. We do that every 2 time slices, and all the data I'll show is typically with 10,000 sweeps or more, which we find is reasonable in terms of giving convergence once we use the parallel tempering. Okay, so let's go back to the actual physics and the actual model. So here I've put it up again. We have the Hopping term with the 4 Fermi surfaces, the electron pockets and the hole pockets, and the interaction term. And so now we can ask, let's consider this interaction at weak coupling and ask what physics do we get. And so this was actually done by two gentlemen in Stuttgart a couple of years ago, and this is the phase diagram they get. Here's plotted negative G increasing towards the right. And so what they find is that at weak coupling, there is no instability to the nematic order, but it's a finite coupling transition to the nematic order. And here N stands for normal metal, and here ON is the uniform nematic ordering. They actually find that at very low temperature, the ordering wave vector for the nematic is very slightly shifted away from 0, 0 along the principal axis, but that is probably an artifact of the mean field theory. And so this is at reasonably moderate G, and let me just say that this temperature here is compared to the nearest neighbor hopping, T1. Some reference values are that the bandwidth is about 15 T1, and that the individual size of the Fermi pocket is about 5 T1. And so these are low temperatures, but still temperatures which are accessible in the quantum Monte Carlo calculations. So in addition to the ordered nematic phase, they find superconductivity. And essentially what this superconducting rise here is just weak coupling superconductivity. You have an attractive interaction. That attractive interaction causes some pairing between the fermions that'll give you some essentially BCS-like interactions. What is particularly interesting is that close to the transition, they have this peak in the superconductivity, and that peak comes exactly from the critical fluctuations of the nematic order parameter, which slightly enhance TC. And that you can see, for example, in Eliasberg theory. So, yes.
Is it first order transition in the calculation, or?
It's a second order transition at all temperatures.
The superconductivity stays finite.
The superconductivity stays finite. So essentially, they do the simplest possible Eliasberg Z phi calculation, and they get a renormalization of Z, and that's what's stopping the fluctuations from making the temperature diverge.
So this is like an honest semi-honest.
Yeah. So they include the wave function normalization of the fermions, and that's what cuts you off. Okay, so we went out to try and numerically simulate this. Now, one thing I should stress, which is quite important, is that the system is very sensitive toward, the model is very sensitive towards doping. So the picture I've just shown you for the mean field theory was at chemical potential mu 0.6 that corresponds to this, and here in the middle. And you see that the RPA susceptibility for the nematic, if we've plotted as a function of Q, has a peak at 0, 0. And that's why we expect ordering in the uniform nematic channel. But if you dope it either strongly towards the whole doped sides, then the electron pocket disappears, and then the RPA susceptibility is peaked at pi pi. Whereas if you strongly electron dope, the RPA susceptibility actually peaks at 0 pi or pi 0 in some stripe pattern. And so this is, of course, going to be a challenge for us because we're dealing with a model that we're dealing with a reasonably small-sized lattice, 12 by 12, 10 by 10, and we're trying to sample this entire complicated Fermi surface structure. The other thing I should mention before I move on, just to go back, in terms of the interactions G, if you want to compare roughly to Hubbard model, to the Hubbard model, if by any chance this is something that is a good reference value, then the normalization of G and is so that an equivalent Hubbard U would be roughly 2 to 3 times bigger. So around here, the Hubbard U shown is about 5 to 6. And what I'll show in just a moment is that the Hubbard U, that the interactions we have to go to actually see interesting behavior is a lot bigger. Okay. So we went away and did the simulation and were very hopeful to find uniform nematic order, but we didn't. Yes?
Is there a way to understand the shift in the wave vector as a function of This is the weak coupling.
This is essentially just from the band structure, from the bubble. There is no particular nesting or special property of the Fermi surface that would necessarily prefer one dominant wave vector. So it's really just about the details of the band structure. So we went away very hopeful looking for the uniform pneumatic phase, and we didn't find it. So instead, what we found are two different orders. One is a so-called antiferronebatic, or more technically correct, antiferroquadrupolar order, which we find at very low temperatures and at high interactions. Here I've schematically drawn the pattern for this order, where essentially the orbitals polarize, but instead of uniformly polarizing, they alternate orbital 1, orbital 2, orbital 1, orbital 2 between the different sites. And then we have some superconductivity that comes in and peaks at a temperature much higher than we expect, but is distinct from the from this antiferronematic phase, and quickly dies down once we enter the antiferronematic. We don't see any sign of any uniform ordering, but let me comment on that a little bit later. So basically what I want to do for most of the rest of the talk is to show some data that tries to illustrate that phase diagram, this phase diagram, and why we believe this is the phase diagram for the model as we can simulate that.
Yeah.
G here is increasing in magnitude here, but because it's negative, that's why I drew the axis this way. Apologies. So this is at strong coupling, this is at weak coupling. And again, here at weak coupling, we have nothing. Then as we increase the coupling, we first see a superconductor, and then the antiferronematic phase. And we only see the antiferronematic phase at half filling. And I'll show this in more detail in just a moment. But if we imagine we have some filling on one axis, then only at close to half filling do we actually see this ordering pattern. Yeah?
Is this S wave S plus minus or S plus plus?
So what we see is purely A1. So the simplest S plus plus S wave.
But in terms of symmetry, there's no.
You're right. So we can't. So we haven't done. To give an honest answer to your calculation, we would have to do an orbital. So essentially, in Fourier space, cut out the according to the Fermi surfaces and do the sine weighting. We haven't done that. We've essentially.
Feature, right? So I think if you have off-diagonal pairing.
Yeah. So we've looked at, and I'll come back to this, but we've looked at pairing in all channels, on-site nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor, and the only appreciable responses we see is on-site A1 and nearest neighbor A1, but actually not the trivial one, a B1 cross B1 on nearest neighbors, but nothing further.
Another question is that in this AF and this antiferromagnetic magnetic order,
yeah.
Is the system an insulator or is conducting?
We think it's an insulator as far as we can tell. I'll comment on that also just in just a second. So let me first briefly explain what I'm going to show. I'm going to essentially show three different quantities. The first is the pneumatic correlation function at equal time. And the one thing I want to emphasize is that I will use a convention where I normalize everything by the spatial volume L squared of the system, which means that ordering saturates as a function of system size. To actually get a better handle on the ordering for the pneumatic, it's better to look at the Binder ratio. The Binder ratio essentially gives a measure for if the fluctuations are around a zero value, in which case the fourth moment and the second moment around the Gaussian value canceling in such a way that the Binder ratio is zero, or if you fluctuate around a finite ordered value, in which case the Binder ratio is 2/3. The other thing I'm going to show is the superconducting correlation function, again at equal time, to get an order parameter out. And I'm going to compare two different parts of the superconducting correlation function. One is at q equals 0, and one is along the maximum diagonal r, which I've sort of sketched here. And so, of course, in the thermodynamic limit, in an ordered phase, you expect them to approach the same finite value. But of course, we're dealing with small lattice sizes with large finite size effects. And so we really have to do an extrapolation to bigger lattice sizes to see if we can get, if we see superconducting order. OK, so with that brief introduction, let me show you some of the data. So here I'm showing the pneumatic correlation function per site at q equals pi pi, which is exactly the anti-ferro-pneumatic or anti-ferro-quadrupolar order. And we see no indication of uniform pneumatic ordering at all. And we don't see any indication of any ordering until we hit beta equals 8. And then essentially we see nothing at weak coupling. This is roughly the area where the mean RPA would have predicted the phase transition to the uniform state, and there's nothing there. And only once we get to very high interaction do these actually shoot up in a sharp way, indicating the onset of order. And because it's an anti-ferro pattern, there's a strong odd-even effect. That's why the odd lattice sizes are so much smaller. To really see that there's ordering, it is better to look at the Binder ratio, as I mentioned, which is the ratio of the which gives the ratio of the fluctuations. And what we see is that here I've only plotted the even lattices 4, 6, and 8 in order to avoid odd-even effects. We see that the Binder ratio is 0, essentially around for weak coupling, indicating no order, and then it slowly starts wandering up to 2/3, where we're just entering the ordering phase here. And the fact that the Binder ratio has a dip just before it enters the ordered phase is a characteristic signature of being a first-order transition. Having said that, we actually expect this dip to get bigger and sharper as we go to bigger lattice sizes, where it actually gets a little bit smaller as we go to bigger lattice sizes. And we don't know if this is a finite size effect or it's just sort of something that we're sampling a reasonably complicated Fermi surface and not sampling enough points within it. Just to give some values again, if we want to compare to the Hubbard model, this is a Hubbard model U equivalent of around 12 to 14 at a temperature beta equals 8 in this model. If you want to map that onto a Hubbard model, that is a beta of around 20 to 24. And that's really starting to push the limits of the numerics that can be done using this algorithm on a double precision machine. So it's really, we have to push it to quite extremes beyond what we thought to see this onset of order. And just to show you that this really is a half filling effect, here I've plotted the average filling per site along the same chemical potential slice along that we're working mu equals 0.6 for the different lattices. There are big finite size effects, so that at weak coupling we get slightly different fillings. Nothing happens as we increase the temperature until we hit the range where we enter the anti-ferro-pneumatic regime, and that's at half filling. And so to come back to your question, so we think it's an insulator. A good measure of way of measuring that is to do the analytic continuation of the Green's function and look for gaps. That turns out to be a little bit more complicated to do. We've looked at the Green's function in imaginary time, you know, as much information as that'll give, and everything seems to be consistent with the fact that that's just a mod insulator. So here we have the average filling per site. So that here we are half filling. We have an up and a down electron in one orbital on one site, and the other orbital empty, as a function of g. So the partition function is at constant chemical potential. And so this is at one fixed chemical potential, the same slice that I was just showing you here. And it's just to show that we only see this regime of the anti-ferronematic really when we are at half filling. And as soon as we start doping away from that, the order dies. And that's consistent with the usual picture that we have from a strong coupling regime, that when we sit at half filling, we can map that onto a spin model and set by the hoppings. And also from that strong coupling expansion for the parameters that we use, you actually expect this anti-ferro pattern.
So the second slide, you could also do, it's more or less like compressibility in some sense, because you are, is it right?
Sorry?
This slide compressibility?
We haven't explicitly looked at the compressibility, but essentially, yes, we have the data. We could.
We didn't look at explicitly. As you said, we looked at the Green function imaginary time, which isn't perfect, but it's at least consistent that when you analytically continue it in real time, it looks like it's just an insulator with a gap. Great. Sorry, you had another question.
I was about the compressibility.
Okay. So once we got this data, and we've been sitting on it for quite a while, essentially we were disheartened because from the perspective of superconductivity, we don't expect any particular favoring of the superconducting order due to this anti-ferro state. I mean, it's mod insulator, and the fluctuations, if they couple at all, would only couple to some certain hot spots. There isn't any nesting or anything particular in this model. Which is why we were very surprised that when we looked at superconductivity, we found it in a regime just above in doping and in interaction just above where the antiferronematic order sets in. So the antiferronematic order jumps up here, and here I've plotted the on-site A1 superconducting correlation function along the maximum diagonal for different lattice sizes, 6, 7, 8, 9, we see that essentially there's a peak. And this is what we expect. And it's, the normalization is such that we expect this to saturate as a function of system size as we increase the lattices. So the fact that these data points seem to lie on top of each other is what indicates that we actually have superconducting order. Now, to do this in more detail, we should really look at finite size scaling. So here's the same data for the maximum diagonal superconducting response function in green as a function of 1 over the volume. And here is the Q equals 0 normalized in such a way, again, that it saturates to some finite value in the ordered state. And of course, in the thermodynamic limit, the short range contributions to the Q equals 0 should be small. And these two should approach each other, extrapolated to some finite value if the system actually is superconductive. And so we can go through all the data points and see for when the extrapolation that we have, it seems to extrapolate to a finite value. Just to give you a comparison, if we go to high temperatures, BK equals 2, this is the more typical plot where we get some superconducting response, but it's small. And then as we increase the system size, the scaling is perfectly consistent, which is going to 0. And so we don't have any superconductivity here. OK, so up till now, I've only shown one chemical potential slice where we go to half filling and where we see the superconductivity. It would now really be interesting to see, well, if we dope the system in various other ways, how does the superconductivity behave? And so this is what I've plotted here. Here I've picked out one lattice size 9 by 9 and shown a very rough sketch of a phase diagram where the interaction is again the bottom from 0 to 4. Here's the occupation, here's half filling, and here's electron doping and hole doping the system. And these lines here are the lines of constant chemical potential along which we do our simulations. And what we see is that at half filling, as the data was that I just showed you, it goes dark. That means no superconducting response. We're in the mod insulating state. That's it. But we get an appreciable superconducting response in this entire region here which is also strongly asymmetric. On the whole doped side, we essentially get very little response. And actually, if we look at the points in detail, all these data points here are consistent with superconductivity scaling to zero in the thermodynamic limit, where all the points here are consistent with scaling to some finite value. What's even more surprising about the superconductivity is that when we go to higher temperature, to a case where we didn't see any antiferronematic order, we still get an appreciable superconducting response. And now in a smaller window here, if you actually look at the data in detail, you see the superconductivity converges to some finite value consistent with superconducting order. So this is a long way away from the original picture that we had from a uniform pneumatic order that would enhance superconductivity. What we really seem to be seeing here is a Mott insulator at half filling that once you start doping it away from half filling becomes superconducting. Having said that, I want to go back to the RPA slide I had and remind you that as you changed chemical potential, the system would want to order in a lot of different ways. And so clearly you have a lot of different competing wave vectors, q equals 0, q equals pi, q equals 0 pi, that are competing with each other to ordering tendencies. And that fluctuation we think really drives the fact that there's a stable superconductor in this big region. One of the surprising things we saw was if we look again at the same slice I showed before, which is this one, if we look at the pneumatic correlation function at q equals 0, the uniform pneumatic order that we're looking for, we see that it is peaked exactly in the region around which we see superconductivity. This peak here is the biggest for 6 by 6. It then decreases for 7 by 7, 8 by 8. The normalization is, again, such that if it were ordered, it would saturate to some finite ordering value. And also in the Binder ratio, we don't see any evidence of the uniform pneumatic ordering in some small pocket before the antiferronematic, which sets in here. But it's interesting because there is evidence of uniform fluctuations. And actually, if we look at all the other chemical potentials I showed you in that big phase diagram, then in the entire range where we see superconductivity, we see evidence of pneumatic fluctuations, which are big for the smaller lattice sizes, but then die as we go to larger lattice sizes and don't actually tend to order. And so this competition, we think, is really what causes the enhancement of the superconductivity to such high temperatures. So we wanted to ask, is there really a way that we can, you know, force the system to order in a uniform pneumatic way? Is there a way that we can guarantee that the system does it and then see what happens to superconductivity to really try and see if we could show this connection between a uniform pneumatic phase transition and the superconducting dome around it? So in order to do that, we changed our model very slightly by adding an extra term to the interaction. So here, the interaction term, instead of just being on site, is along the bonds between nearest neighbors. But you see that if I expand this quadratic piece, then I get the same delta i's on site that I had before, in addition to a cross term to delta i, delta ni, delta nj. And that cross term is what forces the orbitals to polarize in the same direction along the entire lattice. And so the same phase transition we just saw a moment ago, ordering to the antiferronematic, we now expect to order to the uniform antiferronematic, roughly in comparable, on comparable energy scales. And so if we had superconducting enhancement due to that phase transition, we expect to, you know, see what happens to this superconductivity we saw in the other model. But although we see a rather beautiful q equals 0 phase transition, we see no evidence of superconductivity at all, and everything seems to scale to 0. So here I just wanted to plot some data just to show that we have the uniform pneumatic transition. This is q equals 0, delta n, delta n. This is actually at very high temperatures. Already at beta equals 1, the system orders. Maybe it's better to look at the Binder ratio, where you see rather beautifully that the curves cross at a phase transition. But as we decrease the temperature of the system, there's absolutely no evidence of superconducting order at all. What limits us in temperature as we decrease the temperature further and further is actually that we start to see finite size effects that eventually we essentially see shell patterns coming around because the temperature is far beneath the size of the that the finite lattice is sampling in our simulation.
Do you see enhancement of conducting susceptibility
in So, yes, that's a good question. So, of course, the superconducting responses have an you see when you hit the phase transition that the superconductivities of the various channel either decreases or increases. And I believe the S-wave channel has a slight increase as you hit the superconducting transition. But actually, this is not an enhancement or a dome in any way, and it's just a slight increase that then continues. And we have no clear evidence that there's a enhancement due to fluctuations at all. Yeah.
Does it become insulating in this case?
That's a good question. So off the top of my head, I think for the chemical potential I show here, it does become insulating. But for other chemical potentials that we looked at further, because essentially this chemical potential is already somewhat close to half filling. For other chemical potentials we looked at, there's also a uniform transition, and they're over 10% away from half filling, and we still see the transition and no superconductivity or evidence of superconductivity. Of course, you have to do the finite size extrapolation and see, ask if you believe that this orders to a finite finite value, but everything we see is consistent with the superconductivity being zero. That's the sharp statement.
Here it looks more continuous transition than in the previous.
Here it looks more continuous essentially because I'm showing the data from much higher temperature where the system, it's just easier to simulate the system, and it's a little bit better converged. As I said, in the other case, the simulations that we are doing here at -4 and beta equals -8, these are rather extreme temperatures where we run into a lot of numerical problems. I think one of the reasons we can simulate these even in principle as we can is because the superconductivity helps gap out some of the system. And so that's what overcomes some of the finite size problems that we see at equivalent energy scales in the uniform pneumatic model.
Does it look right now that in this case you more or less have a direct transition from a superconductor to an antiferrin?
Yes, as I said, this transition looks first order. It occurs exactly in the region where the superconductivity drops down sharply, but I'm not sure I could make any particular comment about the detailed nature of this transition. On general grounds, you don't expect this transition to be second order. In mean field theory, but I don't think our numerics go to sufficiently large system sizes to make any good finite size scaling on the nature of the transition at these values. Yeah.
So about this uniform pneumatic.
Yes.
You said that happening is an insulator. Is that right?
So, for the uniform pneumatic case, for this one.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. For this model, it said that at happening in this uniform phase, model, the system is insulating.
It gets drawn towards half filling here too. Essentially, this comes because you're working at finite chemical potential. As you increase mu, it's energetically favorable to pull in more carriers. I would have to look up whether or not this model actually gets insulating. I don't believe so, but I'd have to look it up.
So you can't be clean all the actions off the same orbital.
Correct.
Except that as approaching this decoupled chain, right, where because the hopping, So it's actually a d-orbital system.
You have a d-orbital system, and you have hopping between the orbitals, which is quite different from, say, so to some extent, the orbital label is like a spin label, except that you have direct hopping between them, and that actually changes, it changes that. I would have to look it up. I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm sorry. Okay, that, and with that, that's essentially most of the data I want to say. So I think one of the surprising thing is the fact is that we see the enhanced superconductivity. We, from the perspective of the pneumatic fluctuations, we see it in a situation that we didn't expect. The RPA for the on-site model is different. We don't have any evidence for pneumatic order, but we have the antiferronematic case, which appears at strong coupling at half filling. That doesn't necessarily mean that pneumatic order isn't right around the corner. We have evidence of the uniform pneumatic fluctuations, and it might really be that the uniform pneumatic order does set in at lower temperatures or in a slightly different regime of parameter space that we can't access. Coming back to the superconductivity of the iron selenide, the links between what the numerics actually gave us and our original intentions were quite different. But one of the things I will say is that just like an iron selenide, when we see the strong enhancement of superconductivity, it only lives on the electron pockets. Here we have the big asymmetry between electron and hole doping, where the superconductivity also only seems to live on the electron pockets, and it seems to have an order parameter, which is namely just plain S wave, which is consistent with a lot of the experiments which are done on iron selenide. And it would be interesting to see if we can make, if this model, to some extent, at least captures some of the physics that's going on in the iron selenide, doped iron selenide samples itself. And with that, I want to thank you very much for your attention.
Okay. If not, then let's thank Philip again.